The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab.
Conductor José Cerebrier has led the world's great orchestras, making more than 100 recordings and earning numerous Grammy Awards and nominations. His most recent recording features Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra performing orchestral transcriptions of music by Johann Sebastian Bach, as well as anonymous ancient liturgical melodies, music from George Frideric Handel's Messiah, and a selection from Henry Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas. Now, I would like to start, Maestro, with the basics, and would you please explain what a transcription is?
That's very interesting. You know, the record I made now, the latest one is the fourth version of transcriptions by Stokowski. He never used that name. He did later on in life, but he was coined by a record producer a long, long time ago, wondering what to call these orchestrations. Stokowski didn't like, and I don't like either, the word arrangement. They're not really arrangements because the originals are kept very much in place. So it's simply what the word says. It's a very good word. It's transcribing works which were originally written for the organ, in some cases for the harpsichord or piano, for another medium, in this case the orchestra. So it's exactly what that means, transcribing those pieces from one medium, the organ or piano or harpsichord, to the big orchestra. And the reason for that, I'm ahead of myself. He only asked me what the word means, but let me add a little bit to it.
Sure.
The reason for that is that when Stokowski started his career in London and then in New York, he was an organist in two churches, cathedrals, and he was playing mostly music of Bach and the Baroque period. And later on, when he became a conductor, he missed that wonderful repertoire. And he also realized that people didn't know in the early part of the 20th century, audiences didn't know the music of Bach. The only time they heard it was when they went to church. And even then, they didn't know what they were hearing. So it was a reason. He wanted the world to know his fantastic music, and he brought it to the orchestra.
Ah, okay. Well, you sort of touched on what my next question was, which is, you know, most of the music on this new recording is by Johann Sebastian Bach. And I was wondering whether, you know, and of course, if you look around at what's available, there are a lot of transcriptions, performances available, and it's often of Bach's music. I was wondering if there is something about Bach's music that lends itself especially well to transcription.
Well, first of all, in the sense that they were written, many of them, a majority for organ. And when you look at the Baroque organs and some modern organs, one can see that the buttons that the organist has to press to make the sound come out have names. They say violins, violas, violoncellos, double basses, oboe, flute, trombones. So in that sense, it was perfectly made for orchestration. In fact, when organists play the music, they are playing an orchestra because the organ is built that way to, in effect, imitate the sounds of an orchestra.
So then that really would be a really good reason to transcribe music to begin with, simply because it really is enhancing the way we're experiencing the music when it comes from organ.
Yeah. Okay. And I should add, I myself have orchestrated or transcribed many works written for other instruments. Some of them were songs by Edvard Grieg for voice and piano. Grieg wrote over 100 songs, but only orchestrated 5 of them. The others, when I looked at the piano and voice music, I realized they were really orchestral. He just didn't get around to it. So for me to transcribe those for the orchestra was so easy. It was literally just copying the music. Some music is already made for orchestration. Others not. Other works are so idiomatic that they lose by transcription.
There's one thing that I guess I feel, and I think is probably sort of the accepted common wisdom or whatever, that Bach's music is sort of known for being very emotional, of course, but in a very restrained way and in a very measured sort of way. I don't know if those are even the best words, but those are the best I can think of. And some of these transcriptions are, they're thrilling. They're quite passionate and they're very romantic. And I was wondering if that is maybe part of the point, too, that it allows for a little bit more of the drama to come out.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. But don't forget that most of these transcriptions were being done by Stokowski and other people, not only him. In the early part of the 20th century, or early in the 20th century, when we were still living a really post-romantic period, and it wasn't just Stokowski, but a composer by the name of Reger and the other conductors like Mitropoulos and many others were doing similar style transcriptions or orchestrations with big orchestra with a big romantic palette.
I was very curious, I am very curious about your path to music because you had this really very early start at, you know, conducting at 11,
yep.
Graduating from music school at 15, writing your first symphony at 17, and really you were a child prodigy. And I was curious to know if you grew up in an especially musical household.
Not at all.
Uh-huh.
Not at all.
Really?
No, not at all. There was no music in my home. I have some musicians in past generations, but no. My father was an engineer. He came from Russia to Philadelphia, and his company sent him to South America to do some work, and I was very lucky to be born in Montevideo, Uruguay. It's a beautiful town and all surrounded by beaches. And at the time I was born there, there was a great deal of cultural life. Many of the great musicians from Europe, like Erich Kleiber, one of the greatest conductors of all times, came to live there. I never met him. It was before my time, but all of these people created the right medium, not only in music, but in art, poetry, literature, science, everything, during the later years of the Second World War. So I was born there. Music just came to me as a natural thing without any prompting at all from my family or my parents.
Hmm. Was that an obstacle, you know, with a father who was an engineer? Was he saying, you know, go get a real job, or was he supportive?
Well, they were kind enough not to tell me so, but I could sense it. I could sense it. Well, if that's what you really want to do, go ahead, but good luck. I had to buy my own violin with my savings. Uh-huh. They didn't push me one way or the other,
uh-huh.
But as success began to happen, they were relieved, of course,
uh-huh.
Because
uh-huh.
It's a very tough life to be a musician, a composer, a conductor, a performer.
Uh-huh.
It's very difficult.
Uh-huh. Although you got a wonderful start, these transcriptions on your new CD are by Leopold Stokowski, as you were saying before, and you worked for him as associate conductor, is that right, in Carnegie
yes.
Hall?
Yes.
So how did
after, yes, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Tell me about that.
Well, no. After he you mentioned that I wrote a symphony when I was 17, Stokowski premiered it as a last-minute replacement for the long-scheduled premiere of the Ives Symphony No. 4. This is the Symphony No. 4 by Charles Ives, which Ives never heard. It was impossible to play. The musicians of the Houston Symphony could not get past the first bar. It was so difficult. So it was just so lucky that a musician in Stokowski's orchestra showed him the manuscript of my first symphony. And Stokowski said, oh, this is just what I needed, because he had announced the world premiere. So he did my humble little symphony in its place.
Uh-huh.
And then a couple of years later, I was already 19 then, he organized his last orchestra, the American Symphony in Carnegie Hall. And he remembered me, because I told him at the time I really want to be a conductor more than a composer. And he invited me to assist him and gave me the fancy title of associate conductor. And I auditioned all the players and prepared them and so on.
Hmm.
So it was a very wonderful opportunity.
What was that like? What was that like working with an iconic musician like Stokowski?
Well, it was a great experience. I was too young to really take advantage, full advantage of it. As I was too young when I studied composition with Aaron Copland at Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm.
And And I studied conducting with Pierre Monteux and Antal Doratti, two of the greatest conductors of the 20th century. I was really too young to appreciate, but something always stays in. And similarly, working with Stokowski, he never gave me a word of advice, unfortunately, but I learned enormously by watching him. So working with him was a fantastic opportunity because he had this great tradition in his memory and his blood from the late 19th century. And mostly, I learned from him the technique of rehearsing an orchestra, which is very important. It's half the battle.
Mm-hmm.
He was so organized. His rehearsals were planned like a captain or like a general going to war. Everything was planned. And he always kept the orchestra's interest. That was the best trick. They were never mind bored. They were never mentally absent for 1 second. He had tricks, like he will announce the letter from which he would start, or the bar number, let's say bar number 365. And he will announce the bar number and start conducting almost without giving them time to find the place in the music. So as to keep them constantly on edge, not hysterically, but almost, he will say, bar 300, boom. And anybody who wasn't ready, he will not be reinvited back to play the next concert. So that was one of his tricks, to keep the orchestra's full attention. And there were many such tricks, but the best trick, if you can call it that, was the way that he prepared scores. Everything was planned, and then the artistic part, the inspirational part, was left to the concert. During rehearsals, he was totally businesslike. Mm-hmm. And other great conductors I worked with were just like that. I worked for several years with another great master, Georges Zell.
Mm-hmm.
When he was in Cleveland, he invited me to go there as composer in residence. And the first time he asked me, I didn't accept because I was working with Stokowski and I thought, this is New York, it's a great opportunity, and Carnegie Hall and so on. And Stokowski was already in his late 80s. I thought I shouldn't miss that opportunity. But then, one day, Stokowski announced that he was moving back to England. He was already almost 90. And I thought, well, then I should accept Zell's invitation. And I went to Cleveland and I watched him prepare the orchestra in Cleveland. And it was, even though his method of working was, of course, very different, but basically it was the same attention-grabbing detail with the orchestra. Mm-hmm. There was never a dull moment. They were there from first thing in the morning until they left. They were there depending on every motion and every word.
Hmm. So you've had some really iconic mentors in your musical career. But I want to ask you about one little detail that seems to be somewhat unique to you, and that you're known for not using a baton when you conduct. So I'm wondering what that is about. Why is that?
Well, it's not always. When I conduct opera, I use a baton because it makes it easier for the singers to see in the great distance between the pit and far reaches of the stage. But when I conduct orchestras, much of the time, I don't use a baton because the hands are more expressive. All the baton does, supposed to do, is an extension of the arm so that the players way back in the brass section, percussion section, can see the beat.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the baton is a piece of wood normally, and although some conductors use fiberglass, but the baton is not an expressive, as expressive as a hand. The hand can show expression much more. So that's the reason. Lately I divided. Sometimes the fast movements I use baton. It's easier for the orchestra to follow the beat.
Mm-hmm.
And for slow, melodic, romantic movements, I put the baton down and I use my hands.
Mm-hmm.
That is a problem sometimes when I don't use the music. You know, I often conduct from memory. So what do I do with the baton? Well, I have arrangements with the first cello on my right side. I just did that in London a few days ago with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. I told the first cellist, and she was not surprised. I said, between movements, I will pass the baton to you quickly. Please give it back to me for the last movement.
Oh.
So I divide it depending on the character of the music.
Huh. I heard you had a little Jean-Baptiste Lully moment at a performance with a baton.
Yeah, that's the only time I made the world news, not because of music making, but I was conducting in Mexico City a long time ago, and a difficult work written by a contemporary Mexican composer for which the orchestra and the chorus was not all on the stage, but surrounding the audience. Mm-hmm. So I had to give cues all around, and at one point, I gave a cue to the choir that was behind me, and they didn't come in. So I gave another cue with his baton, and the baton was not the normal one, which I use a wooden baton. When it breaks, a wooden baton, nothing much happens. It just breaks. But I have been given a plexiglass baton, mm-hmm. which when it breaks becomes a weapon. It's like a knife or a scissor. So it broke, and it went through my left hand. And the orchestra was blood came all over me. And the only reason it became a news, it was the front page in many magazines, it was in Time magazine, and in every newspaper in the world. The only reason was there were some international visitors in Mexico that day, and they had nothing else to do, I guess, so they came to my concert. And so the press was there because of them. And that's how it happened. It came out. In Lully's case, of course, was one of the very first conductors, since you mentioned him. In those days, conductors didn't beat time with their hand. They beat time with a big cane, which they slammed the floor, beating time, literally, mm-hmm. to hear like a metronome, mm-hmm. only much louder. And one day he hit his foot and developed into gangrene and died. In my case, I had no pain at the moment. I was so concentrated on the music that it's like ladies having babies using the so-called Lamaze method, uh-huh. which is your mind concentrates in something else.
Yeah.
My mind was so concentrated in music making, and I wasn't going to stop for any reason.
Sure.
I didn't have pain until the concert ended, and then the pain was unbelievable. I was taken to a hospital to have an anti-tetanus shot, but the nurse was reading the instructions. When I saw her reading the instructions, I decided to forego the infection and took my chances.
Oh, dear.
By the way, a week later, Sir George Scholte had a kind of a similar accident conducting Don Giovanni by Mozart at the Metropolitan Opera. He hurt his right eye, the eyelid, not the eye itself, but the eyelid, and the curtain came down, and they interrupted the performance for about half an hour while he was looked over by the house doctor. And the Metropolitan Opera called the New York Times and the Associated Press and so on, and they said, oh, no, this is old news. These conductors do it every day. And I remember meeting at the airport a few days later, Sir George Scholte, and he jokingly telling me that I had taken the news away from him.
Well, I'm glad that you both survived those incidents.
Absolutely. Batons can be dangerous.
So on a more serious note, I want to just get, you know, sort of your final thoughts or observations or concerns about the state of the arts in today's world. You know, there are a lot of issues facing orchestras, facing education in music and the arts. And I'm just wondering whether you have any kind of perspective or wisdom that you would like to express on that.
Well, wisdom I don't have, but perspective. I am very optimistic about the future of the arts. I think that I'm happy to see young people in some countries more than others. In Finland, all my concerts are filled with teenagers, and it's just a tradition there. It's a very musical country. In Scandinavia in general. In the UK also, there is a great deal of interest in the arts in general, in music. In America and Canada, it depends on the location. It varies from city to city, and it has to do with home environment. Now, a best example about home environment not being always a rule is my own example. As we started our conversation, there was no music in my home as a child. There wasn't even a record player, just a radio. I discovered music when one day in the kitchen the radio was on, and I heard the kitchen music. It fascinated me completely. I knew immediately that this was for me. The home environment helps, but it's not the only essence. The general cultural environment is what does it. I'm very optimistic. I think that things will improve as time goes, and the audiences will renovate themselves. It's not the case right now in many cities across America, especially. The audiences are aging, and you don't see them being replaced by younger people, which is a great pity, not only for the maintenance of the orchestras and the chamber music and so on, but for this enjoyment of this fantastic art form by new generations.
Yeah.
There are great exceptions all over the world. Venezuela is not an example of a great cultural center at all. In fact, just the opposite. And yet Venezuela is being used by the whole world as an example on how to start youth orchestras. There is this mentor called Dr. Abreu who wanted to conduct about some 50 years ago, and they wouldn't let him conduct the local orchestra. He wasn't completely professional. He had several professions, but not necessarily music. So he organized his own youth orchestra, pretty much what I did when I was 11 years old. The National Orchestra in Uruguay wouldn't let me conduct, so I thought, okay, I organize my own. But Dr. Abreu was already a mature man in his late 20s. He organized the youth orchestra. Since then, it's become an example for the entire world. There are now over 100 youth orchestras in Venezuela. And because of that, there is a great deal of musical public. Hmm. And these orchestras are completely subsidized by the Venezuelan government. They are paid full salaries. And this incredible example, starting in the most unlikely environment in Venezuela, is being used in places like Scotland. The youth orchestra in Scotland is importing this idea in Russia, in other parts of Latin America, in Los Angeles. Now they're starting a similar program. So this all speaks very well for the future, and I am delighted. By the way, I work with the youth orchestras in Venezuela myself whenever I have a chance.
Oh.
And youth orchestras all over the world. Just last year, I made a big European tour all over Europe with the National Youth Orchestra of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
This is an entirely different experiment as the ones in Venezuela. Venezuela, they are put together with young kids from the ghettos, literally. And the idea is to keep them away from the streets, just to make sure that they don't use drugs or do worse things. So they use music as a kind of a detriment, and it has turned into something else. Now, the National Youth Orchestra of Spain, this is for kids in ages 18 to 24 that want to be musicians. These are people that went to music school, and they are fantastic, first-class young professionals. I spent a month with them. We went all over Europe and made a film, a DVD that came out a few months ago, which is quite extraordinary. So I do my own modest part in keeping music alive.
Oh, what an optimistic way to wrap this up. I want to congratulate you on your marvelous new recording of Transcriptions. And I want to thank you very much for making time to speak with me.
It's been my pleasure.